This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. With the new year underway, it's often a good time to reflect and look ahead. There are so many self-help books and inspirational Instagram accounts and people who say they're living their best life. But how does one really do that? That's what we're hoping to talk about today from many different aspects with Megan Sullivan and Paul Blaschko, authors of the new book, The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. I'm really excited to be speaking with you both today. When I first started reading the book, it felt as though you were talking to me. Thoughts I've had, things I've wondered, and it felt like a reminder that most of us want the same things, no matter how different we may appear on the outside. And before we talk more about the book, you're both professors at Notre Dame. Can you tell us how you got started teaching a course on the good life? Megan, we can start with you.
Sure. So I've been teaching at Notre Dame for 11 years now. And very quickly when I arrived on campus, I inherited our large intro to philosophy class. Notre Dame, like a lot of Catholic schools, requires all of its students to take philosophy. And I had taught the class the exact same way I had taken intro to philosophy when I was a college student, which was basically like history of ideas in Greece and Europe from 400 BC to 1800 AD. And the whole, you know, concept behind the class was helping students develop enough background knowledge in the history of philosophy and its methods to take 20 more philosophy classes. Well, we polled our students in that class. Like, how many of you guys could imagine becoming a philosophy major thinking that the rest of your studies at Notre Dame are going to be oriented around philosophy? 2% of our students would say that they thought they were going to take more philosophy classes afterwards, not because they didn't like it, but because they were going to be engineers or doctors or nurses. And I also started taking a look at what we were teaching in that class. Paul was working with me he was a graduate student at the time, but was helping me think really seriously about what we do with all those freshmen in intro to philosophy. And one telling moment was we'd have this midterm essay question where we would give our students this passage from Aristotle, one of my favorite passages in all of philosophy, where he says, we study moral philosophy not so that we can know what virtue is, like not so we can know what Plato thought virtue is, but so that we can be happy. Otherwise, there's no benefit in it. And we would have our students write out these long essay answers defining the word virtue and what Plato thought of virtue, what Aristotle thought of virtue. And it started dawning on us, like, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. Like, these philosophers all promised that studying these questions is going to improve our own lives. It's going to help us live examined lives. But the way we treat the subject to our students is this kind of dry, stale, dead person topic rather than something that has anything to say about their own good lives. And so that was really the impetus and pushed me and Paul to start thinking, what would happen if we blew up intro philosophy the way we had been teaching it and took Aristotle at his word that, you know, just like you could teach in the Lyceum, 400 BC, 300 BC, these kinds of questions, you could do it just as well in the 2020s in the United States. And that, so that was kind of our impetus. I don't know, Paul, if you wanted to add in kind of what happened next.
Yeah. I think for me, one of the shocking things coming to the classroom was that students didn't see philosophy as deeply practical. And I think part of this is just like an accident of my own sort of history or biography. Growing up, I was constantly going to great philosophers to deal with really practical issues. And I think, you know, some of this comes from growing up in a religious household. And so a household in which if I had a deep question, my parents would just say, I don't know, maybe Thomas Aquinas has something to say about that. But part of it was just, you know, in college, discovering that the kinds of questions philosophers have been asking for centuries are just literally the things that we worry about, you know, like how do you become a better person? Is it possible to become a better person? How much of your action is influenced by your environment and how much of it is something that's under your control? So, you know, coming into the philosophy classroom, seeing that the way that we were framing it was, you know, maybe not helping students connect up the kinds of things that philosophers care about with the things that they already care about. And maybe even as Megan was saying, maybe it was even sort of presenting a barrier to that. So we decided to do was approach, you know, the class both in terms of the content and in terms of the questions that we're asking, but also the format, you know, trying to meet students where they're at by creating, you know, different digitally integrated essays that they can click through and that help them kind of relate to philosophy in the way that they relate to other sort of sources that they would go to if they were looking for inspiration or help or, you know, answers to some of these deep questions, making videos that, you know, help explain, hey, look, like, you know, Aristotle really has something to say about your habits and about, you know, what habits you should have if you want to be a good, productive person. So I think, you know, for me, finding creative ways to connect with them through technology, but also just through, you know, the kinds of questions that we're highlighting and the way that we're framing these really incredible thinkers throughout history. That was the real challenge. And, you know, we started seeing that get some traction with our students. It was just a really exciting thing because I saw the sort of energy that philosophy brings to me in my everyday life in the classroom. So, yeah, it's very exciting.
It sounds like you were able to make philosophy more accessible to students. So I'll just say, I don't think I've ever taken a philosophy class. I don't think it was ever required of me in college. So it's interesting to hear that that's a requirement at Notre Dame. Do you think that's something more people should take into account is getting into philosophy?
I think absolutely. I mean, it's professional malpractice that you never took philosophy, or that so many people feel excluded from philosophy, or feel like, you know, you need a black beret and clove cigarettes and a GRE level vocabulary to do it. Because you don't. If figures like Plato and Socrates and Aristotle are right, what makes us distinctive as human beings is the fact that we worry about whether we are living good lives every single day. You don't always ask yourself it in the philosophical tone, but we consume information about whether we're good parents, about whether our work is meaningful, about when you should retire and how you should plan to be happy once you go through a major life change. Those are all distinctively philosophical questions, and they've always been treated in that vein. And they're also the kinds of questions which you can make progress on in your life by knowing a little bit about philosophy and knowing how to ask philosophical questions. It's not the kind of progress that happens in like a few days or by downloading like a new diet app on your phone, but it is the kind of progress that can happen over a few years. And certainly if you find yourself in a community or a family or a workplace where you have a bit of the skill of being able to take a step back and ask yourself the philosophical why questions and know when your answers are getting better. And so I think Paul and I's like biggest goal with this book is trying to reignite that hunger in people and help them realize that a lot of these questions that they have that seem like, you know, like ordinary or really isolating personal questions are in fact these kind of perennial human questions and the kinds that they can share with other people and that we can, with hard work, make a lot of progress on in our lives.
I think another reason this might be is that, you know, philosophy in our culture, it doesn't have a very distinctive place. Like it gets taught at universities. But I think, you know, oftentimes when I have a question, you know, okay, like how can I change around my habits to be more productive, or, you know, what is it to be a good parent? I'm often looking to different disciplines, you know, psychology or sort of social science disciplines, which are fantastic. I think one thing that Megan's bringing out here and that I absolutely agree with is to discover that some of those questions have a philosophical aspect to them. And then to see that you know, Aristotle or Descartes or Plato or Elizabeth Anscombe have thought, you know, incredibly hard about these things is just illuminating, and it's helpful because you can sort of go into these conversations, these questions, just from a totally different angle and one that, you know, in our culture, we're not always used to thinking in terms of.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say when I was reading your book, it created a hunger in me for learning more about philosophers. And I was like, I gotta go to the library and read up on all of these philosophers and learn more. It was so fascinating too, to see the ties between philosophers and different faith traditions and stuff like that. But I do want to ask, what made you use the title The Good Life for your book rather than God in the Good Life, Paul?
Yeah. So The Good Life, the idea of The Good Life is an ancient one, right? And I think it's one of the more helpful ways of approaching, you know, what we might call ethics. Ethics is a word that, yeah, it gets used in a lot of different ways. And it can actually like obscure the fact that for many centuries, the way that people have thought about morality, about being a good person, is in terms of how to structure and organize our lives. The ancient tradition that we're drawing most from, the virtue ethics tradition, has this idea that, you know, all of us are pursuing different goods, different goals, and that if we structure our lives around those goods, around those goals in the right sort of way, our lives themselves are going to have this kind of value, and we are going to experience that value as a deep sort of happiness. And so, you know, this is a really practical way, I think, of thinking about the issues that arise philosophically when we start thinking about this. So I think we wanted to put that front and center. And then the idea of there being a method, I think, is also really important because, you know, the good life isn't just something that you kind of reflect on, think about, and then just, you know, write down, okay, here are my goals. It's something that you can reason about. It's something that you can have conversations and disagree with other people about, and then offer arguments and sort of enlighten each other. And you can come to some conclusions about, and you know, changing your mind is one of the things that we emphasize in the book is a really important part of that whole process.
Aristotle has this amazing line in the end of his book on happiness and the good life called the Nicomachean Ethics, where he describes his method as the method of facts in life, where he says, you take what the philosophers have said about some important issue, like whether religion is important or what it means to be a good parent or to lead a meaningful life. And the Greeks all spoke on those questions quite a bit. What good work consists in? You take what the philosophers have said and you hold it up against the situation you find yourself in and the world that you're in and the kinds of puzzles and problems that you're distinctively facing. And you try to reconcile the two. And that's the work of philosophy, is trying to like make meaning out of your situation with respect to what everybody else has studied about the kind of situation before. And if it harmonizes, Aristotle says, that's wonderful, you've made progress. And if not, one of the really radical things Aristotle says is if it doesn't kind of harmonize with where you find yourself, that's evidence against those philosophical theories. And that's an opportunity for us to probably need to do some new philosophy for our own times. And so that's a spirit that we really try to share with the readers and with our students, this idea that philosophy has developed alongside of major world religions like Christianity, alongside of our understanding of God and certain theological questions. It's been useful at times to helping develop and answer those questions when they felt really urgent for us. But sometimes it's also a call to like need new philosophy to try to help us make meaning over our situation. And I think a lot of us find ourselves in 2022 thinking that maybe we're at this pivot point where we also need to invest a bit more in philosophy.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the new book, The Good Life Method, by Megan Sullivan and Paul Blaschko. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're speaking with Megan Sullivan and Paul Blaschko, Notre Dame professors and co-authors of the new book, The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. Megan, what was it like to put all of your work into a book that anyone can read now?
Oh my gosh. Well, Paul and I are next door neighbors and also co-teachers. So one of the tremendous reliefs after we signed the contract for this book was that I did not have to try to download my mind into a publicly accessible book. The process for writing this it's the first time I've ever done a big project like this with somebody else who's totally been involved at every stage. And I think this book really originated from conversations that Paul and I had nearly every day from 3 years as we were teaching the class and thinking, what are the big things that we're learning about philosophy as a result of what we're seeing every day in class? What are the questions where we know we disagree? What are the questions where we want to try to convince each other? And that process of having the conversation between the two of us from the very beginning, from like the first day we were working on the book, was transformative because it meant that, you know, a lot of being a professional philosopher, and Paul would say the same thing, a lot of it is having this really complex private inner life. And you do know a lot of these GRE vocabulary words, and you know a lot of background theories. You probably have read way too much. And the art of really good philosophy, certainly the kind of philosophy you want to do with students and your friends, is conversation. And great conversations, you kind of hold back a little bit all of your geeky background knowledge and instead try to get quite to the point of the essence of the question. So I think that one of the things that was really fun and challenging about working on this book for me was it was the first project where from beginning to end, it's a recording of a conversation with another person that I care about.
That's really cool. And Paul, did you have any concerns ahead of time? Like maybe this book would be too insider for readers to appreciate?
I mean, certainly that's a challenge. Trying to explain to somebody why they should care about Descartes' Meditations. I think if you go about it in the wrong way, it's just a dead end. But I had seen enough excitement and enthusiasm from our students. And I had had enough conversations with them and also just, you know, seen them having conversations outside of our class. One of the big parts of our class here at Notre Dame is we have undergraduates lead small dialogue groups with their peers. And so just to see Notre Dame undergraduates get incredibly excited about, you know, this really sort of arcane philosophy sometimes and see them connect it to their everyday lives and then see that dialogue flourish, even apart from the enthusiasm that, you know, we're putting in class, that gave me sort of trust and faith that there was a way of connecting, there was a way of pitching this so that it would be relevant to a really broad audience. But of course, you know, making that sort of actually happen and making sure that you're hitting that, especially when you don't have kind of the types of cues that you have when you're teaching and the types of feedback. That was a big challenge. And I guess I didn't know going in how exactly that would work. I found out the editors were a huge part of that process and massively helpful in giving us feedback and kind of saying, hey, here's how this strikes us. And that was just a really fruitful dynamic as well. But I mean, it's, you know, it's terrifying going in. But I think, you know, just seeing our student sort of reactions to the material gave me hope that this is an achievable goal.
One thing Paul and I also did very intentionally, we have really close relationships with the students that have taken God in the Good Life. And especially the students that come back to be like discussion leaders for the class. And some of them really worked with us on the book, especially in the middle phases. They read chapters and gave us feedback and engaged in philosophical debates. An area where a topic in philosophy that Paul and I just talk about all the time in our personal lives is the problem of evil. We're both religious folks. We're both Catholics. We have very different, like, you know, ways of engaging with our Catholic faith. And the problem of evil is this really famous, infamous philosophical problem of how can a good person believe in an omniscient, morally perfect being when there are just so many horrible things that happen in the world? Where is God when fill in the blank, some awful thing happened? And there are different ways that philosophers try to understand why somebody would believe and worship God, even if there is so much suffering in the world. And you know, Paul and I definitely disagree about which of the philosophical moves is most comforting or seems most rational. And so in the book, you see this debate play out in our discussion about how we handle suffering in the good life and which different philosophers try to offer us different techniques for doing it. But one thing that was really exciting about the writing process was, I mean, Paul and I had had that conversation in little clips over the years, but then working on that chapter and with those students as interlocutors, we really got to lay out what really mattered to us on that question. And we'd been teaching on it for ages in a kind of detached way, but I think it never really gotten to the heart of our personal investment in understanding suffering and how it had affected our lives so far. And I think, especially for those students who were working with us on that chapter, I don't think that they had seen professors wrestle with a philosophical question that's really existentially important to them, but also is the kind of thing that you could do research on Thomas Aquinas and Kierkegaard to start to solve. And so that was the chapter where I think we really discovered the kind of magic for trying to include other people in these conversations.
Paul, you give some exercises in the book to get people thinking about their lives, and exercises involve contemplating philosophical questions. Is this a lost art that we could all benefit from getting back to?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I think, you know, we may have forgotten in our culture and even in professional philosophy is that philosophy originated in kind of a therapeutic mode. Like the Stoics, for instance, who were really early on in the history of philosophy, they were trying to answer the problem that we all face when we realize that a lot of things are outside of our control and this causes great anxiety. And so, you know, the meditations that we find in Marcus Aurelius or Epictetus, They're really sort of practically focused, step-by-step activities that you can do. And, you know, they obviously have theory behind them. You know, Marcus Aurelius refers to the interrelatedness of the cosmos and you know, the sort of home that we have in the cosmos. And so, I mean, that picture, that worldview, that's going to imply a lot of things. And maybe you have to think hard about that and kind of argue about, you know, whether that view makes sense. But at the end of the day, you know, reading the Stoics, you are just doing an activity. You are meditating in a philosophical mode. And I think, you know, we've seen in recent, you know, decades, people are starting to rediscover that in our culture and incorporate that into a lot of different modes of meditation, both like mindfulness meditation and other kind of therapeutic modes. But I think there is something distinctive about, you know, philosophical practices like this. And I think, you know, we can only benefit from the wisdom that those practices contain.
Is there anything societal that happened that caused us to sort of lose this art of philosophizing and not see it as something important?
I think I really came to understand where we were culturally and what we lost when the pandemic happened. So Paul and I were working on this book really actively in 2020. We were in heavy drafting mode. And when everything shut down in March, you know, it's hard even now to go back mentally to that time, but we had these really busy lives. I can remember my Google Calendar just had blue boxes everywhere, like a Tetris game, trying to pack it full of activities and meetings and classes and working on this project and writing time. And then we faced this period where everything was canceled. We were, you know, left to kind of retreat into our homes and with our families and try to find things to do besides just watching television. And also feeling like how much of our good lives were attached to just running from event to event or trying to accomplish like thing after thing and realizing like what's left that's really wonderful in our life when that starts to be threatened or taken away. And I, at least in my adult life, I'd never lived through an experience like that. And I remember we were reading Stoics at that point with some of our students. And these two big Stoic ideas, first, that like the best things in your life are things that are that you can control and they involve your mind and your virtue and things that you you can spend time just reflecting on, regardless of what else is happening. That insight and the one Paul just mentioned, the interconnectedness of all things, like, you know, the experience of the pandemic and COVID helped us realize that, oh my gosh, something that happens on the other half of the globe can significantly affect how I live my life. And likewise, how the decisions I make can significantly affect my community in ways that sometimes I don't even perceive. Like pondering those two thoughts and turning to philosophy as a way of helping us manage and understand that collective experience, I found that really helpful. And I think it was a nice, I'd always struggled to teach the contemplative philosophers. And I've always liked more action-packed, goal-driven philosophy. But the knowing a bit of philosophy as we walked into that quiet period and scary period, that changed forever how I read those guys and what the kinds of skills that I want to cultivate in my life, like this ability to sit back and reflect and think and kind of pull back from the day to day. And I think our culture just until now has been feeding us just the life of action and the action packed vision of the good life.
Right. Right. And Paul, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you should be suspicious if like a philosopher offers you a grand narrative, but I'm now going to offer you a grand narrative. So be suspicious.
Trust me, I'm a philosopher.
I think, you know, I think part of it has to do with the way in which philosophy has been intertwined with a lot of traditions that have changed radically in, you know, our contemporary society. So a lot of the most practical, you know, modes of philosophizing, ways of thinking have been tied up, you know, traditionally with religions, with Christianity or Islam, with Buddhism. And I think in our culture, you know, maybe in sort of the recent history of our culture, when we think about how to improve our lives, when we think about, you know, how to set big picture goals for our life, we often, you know, reach to what's near at hand, which are really helpful ways of thinking, or, you know, psychology, social sciences, et cetera. But I think kind of disentangling and bringing out the different threads in some of these traditions and seeing, you know, the ways in which philosophy and religion and culture are intertwined and the ways in which they connect to each other and the ways in which they're detachable. I think that's a really important element in recapturing what's so valuable about these traditions, these sort of historically important wisdom traditions.
When it comes to sort of religious traditions and debate and discussion, I definitely learned a lot from the book, just how, as a Muslim woman, philosophers like Plato and Aristotle had influence on Islam and some of the debates and discussion. It was really eye-opening for me. And it made me, again, as I mentioned earlier, realize how much more interconnected we are than we may think. And it also made me think that we've lost a lot of that. You know, there's just a lot of just following something without questioning it, without looking into it or trying to understand that. Is that something that you found in your work?
Yeah, Paul and I have been talking a lot about this recently, just watching what's happening on college campuses and in our national debates. We're at this weird cultural moment where questions are typically just used as weapons, either at Thanksgiving dinner or in classrooms. When you say you're asking somebody questions, you're usually just trying to kind of get them on record to make a point, to have an argument with them. When questions have always been like one of the engines of philosophy, just being curious about things or wanting to show people ideas that you have that might answer some of these like really big, woolly, philosophical, why are we here questions. And you see that with Islam and Christianity and Aristotle. So Aristotle's kind of the patron pagan philosopher saint of Christianity. He's the major inspiration for St. Thomas Aquinas and a lot of how we think about what it is to have a soul and what will happen to us when we die and how to understand what God and who God is. That comes from Aquinas, but Aquinas got it by adapting Aristotelian philosophy to what he was learning about his Christian tradition. And he only learned about Aristotle from Islamic scholars who were like, hey, you know, you got to check this guy out. This is like the most fascinating metaphysics we've seen, and this might be really useful to you as you try to build up your understanding. That's obviously, you know, there was a lot of complicated political dynamics as well going on in that period of medieval history. But this spirit of, hey, like, let me show you this really interesting idea. Let me show you this hypothesis about maybe how God works. Let me share with you this idea I have about what might make our lives meaningful given that we're going to die. That spirit of kind of sharing and questioning and wondering is something that we desperately need to recover. And that's something where philosophy is really at its strongest.
Yeah. And speaking of the pandemic, I feel like, as you both mentioned earlier, just having that quiet time to think, it really allowed a lot of people to slow down and sort of reevaluate. And maybe they didn't realize they were philosophizing in some way.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
absolutely. Yeah. I'm currently teaching a class about work and the good life right now. And I think this is one particular area in which people have been doing a lot of philosophy over the past couple of years. And you're seeing it come out in you know, different ways. People are really radically reorganizing the way that work fits into their life and sometimes, you know, making really big changes. So, yeah, I definitely think recognizing that for what it is, like a philosophical question, can really help us make progress on otherwise, you know, seemingly intractable sorts of problems in our life.
Sorry, go ahead. I was just going to say, we have about 2 minutes before break.
There is a really popular wrong philosophical view that's quite prevalent right now, which is that you should measure the goodness of your job or any other activity you're involved in by how much good you're producing out in the world. Like, how efficient are you at pumping things out into the world? And one area where we also think philosophy can help, and this comes up particularly in the chapter on work, is starting to value like integrity again and understanding what it means to be somebody who's not constantly measuring your worth based on how much you're pushing out in your job or in your family, but instead on the reasons that are binding your decisions together. And that's another area where I think a lot of people might find philosophy really therapeutic right now.
How did you decide which philosophers to focus on in the book? We can talk for a few, like a minute on that, and then we can pick up after break.
Yeah, I mean, I can start if that's right. I think all of the philosophers that appear in this book have had a major influence on our thinking. And sometimes it's because our students have introduced them to us. A lot of the students who serve as peer dialogue leaders for the class will come to us and they'll say, hey, I'm really interested in James Baldwin and Sartre. Like, is there any way that we could do a class day on that? And so, you know, some of the philosophers that we end up talking about in the book have come through conversations with those students. But again, each of the philosophers that we talk about in the book, at least in my case, I feel like I've had a personal encounter with them, reading their work has really just changed the way that I think about the world in some significant way.
We're speaking with Megan Sullivan and Paul Blaschko, Notre Dame professors and co-authors of the new book, The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. If you want to reach out to us, you can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobel. Many of us are searching for a life of peace and happiness, less stress and more contentment. While some people are able to achieve that, there are still many who struggle to find it. But is there a way to get to that place where you're living your best life? We're discussing that today with Notre Dame professors Megan Sullivan and Paul Blaschko. They recently released a new book called The Good Life Method. Before the break, we started to tackle a little bit about the book and what philosophers you decided to choose to focus on. I guess, Megan, on the flip side, who did you not put in?
I think we have some philosophy colleagues who are probably going to freak out on us having written a big public philosophy book introducing people to the subject and not having any chapters on René Descartes or Immanuel Kant or some of these, like, you know, really heavy hitting figures in the history of philosophy. And it's not because we don't like those guys. I mean, I think Paul and I read like garbage disposals. We read all kinds of philosophy, and we certainly love the ancient history folks or the Enlightenment history folks in that case. But for me, like as Paul mentioned, we tried to pick the philosophers that we're always referencing when we give our own arguments for why we believe certain things. And also, I'm a voracious news reader and news commentator, and the kind of person who always like reads something in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, gets kind of upset, and then posts something on social media about how a philosopher would fix this bad argument. And I think the philosophers that we reference in the book, some of them you've heard of, but some of them, like Iris Murdoch, maybe you didn't know was a really important figure in 20th century virtue ethics. We think they're the kinds of philosophers that if you familiarize yourself with, you're going to start seeing ways that they help you understand all the stories that we're reading in the news right now. And they're the kinds of people that are easily referenced, like having important insights for the situations that we face. And for better or for worse, like some of the really great minds in the history of philosophy don't quite speak into the particular problems we're facing in 2021, 22.
Well, Paul, what do you think is the biggest obstacle in a person's way that keeps them from living a good life? Were you able to find that answer while putting this book together or even while teaching your classes?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of... there are a lot of things that keep us from reflecting seriously, sort of contemplating what's motivating us, what's driving us in life. I think it's totally understandable. I have three kids. And so, you know, to set aside even a half hour just to think really seriously about, you know, the way that work is playing into my life and how I can arrange that in a way that would sort of make me happy and sort of help my family flourish. I mean, you know, it's difficult, right? It's difficult to find that time. I think too, you know, some of the things that Megan brought up earlier, pressures to live very active lives. I mean, the values that we internalize are often values of productivity and you know, moving quickly and trying to get as much done as we can. I think just finding a way of entering into conversations that allow us to kind of see the assumptions that we're making about where value comes from in our lives, what we think is a good thing, what we think we should be organizing our lives around. somehow finding a way to break into that. And, you know, for me, the way to do that is in conversation with other people and with great thinkers throughout the history of philosophy. That's really what can help us make progress and can help us sort of separate out the things that we're doing just because we think like, well, this is what's expected of us, or, you know, this is what I've got to do to be successful, from the things that we're doing in our life that are really genuinely meaningful that we're going to look back on, you know, in 10 or 20 or 30 years and think like, I'm so glad I spent time on that, you know? I'd say that's probably, you know, in my view, the biggest challenge.
Each chapter in the book kind of covers a different good life question, like love or work or the role of religion or how to have hard political conversations with your family after the holidays. I find myself like returning to different pieces of advice that we offer based on philosophy that we know at different points. And the one that's been really on my mind this season is the chapter on love, where, you know, we talk about Iris Murdoch and Elizabeth Anscombe and some of these philosophers that really thought that moral philosophy needed more of a place for understanding how important love is in our lives. And the role that questions and paying attention to somebody's mind and their stories is a way directly of loving them rather than giving them gifts or trying to do things for them or change them. And in the chapter, we try to take this, you know, somewhat mystical idea of love that comes to us from these philosophers and make it into concrete habits and practices that we could share with people that we love. And I have found, especially after spending 2 years social distancing from people that I really care about, not being able to see a lot of people that I really care about, coming back again and again to these goals for how I want to love other people in my life more philosophically now that we're entering a new phase. And I think this idea that we can set goals for how we love other people, it's something that's distinctive to philosophy, but it's also answering like a really big need that we have right now. And that can change our lives for sure.
Is the good life synonymous with a moral life?
I'm pitching that one to Paul. It depends on what you mean. Biblical philosophy answer. It depends on what you mean by moral.
Yeah. I think, so to dive just, you know, a little bit into a debate that I don't know, we could spend hours talking about. I mean, this is really a question that Elizabeth Anscombe and other philosophers in the 20th century started asking, because for Aristotle, the good life is the excellent life, right? Aristotle thought we've got a function, we've got a purpose in life, and that is to use reason, to use reflection to organize our lives. And virtues, human excellences, are defined in terms of that. A lot of contemporary philosophers don't think that Aristotle would have distinguished between that kind of life, the good life, and morality or ethics, you know, in the way that we sometimes do. So I think, you know, for the virtue ethicist, those ideas are going to be really close together. I think, depending on your views, now I just want to like mark that this is a contentious position. You might think they come apart. You might think, you know, there's an ideal of the good life, and ethics plays some role in that. But you know, some contemporary philosophers think it's not sort of an overriding role. These things come apart. There are non-moral goods. So I want to mark out that that's contentious. But I side with Aristotle on this debate. I think a good life, a really excellent life, it is sort of a moral life. It's one in which the moral virtues kind of suffuse like your life and direct your action.
In the book, we really hope to introduce readers to this ancient tradition in virtue ethics, which, as Paul mentioned, it's still a controversial tradition within philosophy. And the basic point of the debate about morality is whether you think morality is following a set of abstract rules, like never lie, always donate 10% of your income to the poor, no matter what. If you think of morality in that way, then the good life might oftentimes finds itself at odds with some of those principles, because it might be hard to understand how those principles would apply in somebody's particular circumstances. But the way virtue ethicists think about morality, it's not this fixed or static set of abstract rules or principles, but rather it's the way we try to reason through all of the moral problems that get thrown at us every day. How should we help this particular person who's suffering at our workplace right now? how should we tell whether or not we were being as honest as we could be with our partner? And those reasoning through those really particular questions, there's never going to be any like single abstract principle that's always going to tell you what to do. Instead, it's this process of trying to discern what kind of person you want to be, discerning what you really owe this other person, taking responsibility for the mistakes you make. And so if you're willing, if you think of morality as that kind of process of trying to make yourself into a person that's achieved the good life, that's achieved eudaimonia, then morality just has to be part of the good life.
Is it fair to say that there's no perfect answer? There's no, you can't really come up with a specific, I guess when I'm thinking of the good life and when you're applying philosophy and trying to figure out answers to questions, it's on a case-by-case basis. No two people would have the same answer.
Aristotle has this line that he takes from Solon. It's a little bit depressing. He says, count no man happy until he's dead. Like, we won't know. We won't know whether you've achieved the good life or you got an A on this journey of trying to achieve eudaimonia, the flourishing, happy life, the goal, until you've run your course. That doesn't mean that there's not a goal. It just means that it's not the kind of goal you can give yourself intermediate grades on very effectively, because it's going to depend on how you're fitting together all the different pieces of your life and the kind of person that you're becoming as a result of all this philosophy that you're doing. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a goal. It just means it's the kind of thing that it's really hard in just a one-off conversation. Like if you're, you know, sitting around at New Year's trying to judge how everybody's doing at achieving moral lives, you're not going to have a single answer at one particular moment in time. We do think that there are better and worse ways of approaching all of these questions about what kind of life that you're leading. And philosophy, once you appreciate it, can give you pretty strong advice and pretty general advice about the kinds of decisions you ought to make and the kinds of decisions you ought to avoid. Think of maybe one particular example is if you take the philosophy that we introduce in this book seriously, you are going to be missing out substantially on the good life if you only treat other people as like means to your own ends or ways of getting ahead of particular impersonal goals you've set for yourself. That's a bad life for just almost nearly everybody. It's life that we're sometimes tempted to fall into. We might not even realize that that's what we're doing, but philosophy can wake us up to what's going on and also counsel us to stop.
The way I'd put it is, you know, philosophy is not going to give us a formula. Like if you do, you know, X, Y, and Z, then you're going to have the good life. You're going to achieve a good life. It's more like the way in which, you know, different artists can all be incredible, excellent artists in very different ways. It doesn't change the fact that, like, you know, amazing, incredible, excellent art shares some qualities in common. It's just that there are very different ways of realizing that in the world. And I think when it comes to living a good life, something similar applies. There are certainly things that we can say, like Megan's saying, general advice that philosophers can give, kind of an outline that good lives are going to fit within. But the particular decisions and judgments, the ways that one realizes that life, they're going to look very different depending on the individual who's actually doing the living.
Yeah, and I think it's important to have that time to actually think and reflect, because when you're living the busy life and you're on social media and running to work and meetings, you really don't have time to think about any of these things.
Oh, absolutely.
So you're preaching to the choir.
I deactivated all my social media back in like April to see how I would do without it. And it's a very weird world to be in.
I just keep using my Facebook to get into philosophical fights with people. it's like the guy, you know, I feel like Socrates of Facebook. Like I just walk around looking for a conversation or itching for an argument.
Before we wrap up, I am curious about there's an idea in some religious traditions that we aren't here to live a life of ease, but rather to suffer and deal with whatever comes our way without complaining. How does that fit into the good life method, if at all?
So it's really important. And we start this with the first chapter. There are two different ways we could think about happiness as a goal. One is this, like, you know, experience of feeling happy, the kind that you get when life is going easy and all of your like neurons are firing in the right way and you've just had your first cup of coffee of the day. that's not the kind of happiness that philosophers are setting out as the goal of working on philosophy. Instead, for philosophy, happiness is a kind of achievement. It's becoming a certain kind of person who's developed all of these core human virtues like courage and generosity and justice and love, and has figured it out over the course of a life that they've lived, often probably a life that threw increasing obstacles in their way and had suffering as an important dimension of it. That's to say that I don't think we have to accept this dichotomy that people who care about the truth or are part of a Christian or Jewish or Muslim tradition have to either pick like feeling happy all the time as their goal, and we set that up as the secular ideal, or a life of constant suffering and sacrifice until the next good life begins in the afterlife. There's this middle way that virtue ethics provides, and that's been really important to a lot of these traditions throughout history as well, which is that in this life, we're meant to achieve these certain distinctively human goods. We're meant to work on virtue, and we're meant to overcome obstacles, but also feel more fulfilled as a result. And that is helping us understand in this life and giving us the materials to contemplate in this life all of the good things that might happen in the next. And that's kind of nice. Like, very, you know, in a world where we often get really harsh dilemmas that we have to decide, I think this is an area where virtue ethics says you don't have to make a really awful trade-off. You can have a really important kind of happiness in this life that prepares you for the spiritual life that your religious tradition promises you as well.
What is next for both of you? Is there anything that you're working on?
I'm writing a big nerdy book about love's role in moral philosophy. So if this book was to try to convert all of your listeners and the general public to how important and interesting virtue ethics and philosophy is for their lives, the book that I'm working on right now is trying to convince philosophy professors and other moral philosophers that they should care a lot more about these moral ideas that are part of a lot of our everyday lives, but weirdly enough, don't show up in a lot of research papers or more academic books on the subject. And I'm very interested in trying to make it feel much more urgent in contemporary academic discussions, how important love is in our lives and how that guides our moral thinking.
Yeah, and I guess the projects that I'm working on right now have mostly to do with work in the good life. So I'm teaching a class right now on this idea, and then I'll be starting a program here at Notre Dame aimed at helping students really sort of look, at their life as a whole and start thinking about the ways in which questions, philosophical questions about living well are really intertwined with these questions about how we work, about the values that we bring to work, about how much of ourselves we give to it. And obviously, you know, these are questions that I think a lot of us are thinking about. So my big project is trying to kind of crack that specific area of the good life and really figure out how we can fit work into a well-lived life.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Megan Sullivan is the Wilsey. Wait, is it Wilsey or Wilsey?
Wilsey. And okay. He'll listen to this episode.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. Megan Sullivan is the Wilsey Family Professor of Philosophy at Notre Dame University, and Paul Blaschko is an assistant teaching professor in the Department of Philosophy at Notre Dame University. They're also co-authors of the new book, The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also reach out to us on Twitter or Facebook at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.